Funds for the California Report are provided by Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information available at chevron.com. The California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. URSCorp.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, stuck between a rock and a hard place. UC and CSU leaders hold their noses and raise student tuition again. And in Sonoma County, a program that helps abused and abandoned horses back to health.
He was emaciated. He was just skin and bones. There was no palpable fat on his body. He was literally a living lesson in anatomy.
Also, a Showtime series starring the San Francisco Giants premiered this week. A team of filmmakers is spending most of the baseball season with the world champs, promising to find drama on and off the field.
Sport is arguably, if not the last great bastion, one of the greatest reservoirs of unscripted drama. You just kind of can't make it up, the stuff that goes on.
It's the California Report. Well, as college students were enjoying their summer breaks this week, the leaders of UC and CSU campuses took steps to make the fall semester even more expensive for them and their families. In Long Beach Tuesday, California State University trustees voted to increase tuition by 12%. University of California Regents followed suit 2 days later, voting to raise tuition by 9.6% at the 10 UC campuses. Our education reporter, Anna Tintakalis, is here to help us understand what it all means. And Anna, I know you attended the UC Regents meeting in San Francisco this week. Give us a sense of what the atmosphere was like there among the regents and those who were in the audience.
Well, it is summer break, and while you saw some really heated action in Long Beach at the CSU meeting, you didn't see that in Northern California. There was about 15 students who appeared with some signs. There was really no chanting. You know, students are working. They're back at home, and they're kind of disconnected with what is happening on campus right now. So for student organizers, it was really hard for them to really rally the troops. So the mood at the UC Regents was somber.
And what's the justification for the tuition increases? You know, how is the money going to be used? Why was it necessary to raise the tuition yet again this year?
Well, the UC system with this new state budget is facing $650 million in loss in state funding. So what you're hearing time and time again is we have to raise tuition in order to preserve the integrity and reputation of the UC system, which basically means we need to keep our faculty, we need to keep our programs, we need to keep our classes. And we hear from the Regents chair, Sherry Lansing, about her regret in having to do this.
We feel that we have to maintain the quality or it will rapidly disappear today. So this is where it stops. And we have to now continue this fight.
And the concern, Anna, I guess, is in part that this is really going to become so expensive that a lot of families, a lot of students just won't be able to attend college in California. Is that what it is, bottom line?
Yeah, I mean, I think the real concern now is middle-class students and what is going to happen to their college dreams. Because for low-income families, they still get a pretty sizable financial aid package or help.
Well, and in fact, some of this increase goes toward that, right?
One-third of the tuition-generated revenue will go towards financial aid, but many middle-class students don't qualify for that. And then you have the wealthier families who, for many of them, this is still a bargain when you take a look at four-year public institutions.
Now, again, focusing on the regents, most of the UC regents are appointed by the governor. A few are also elected state officials who sit as ex officio members. How did the politics of these tuition hikes play out, especially at that regents meeting this week?
Well, you know, there was a lot of talk about other ways to cut or even to generate more money. There was talk about recruiting more out-of-state students and efforts efforts to really aggressively fundraise. But it all came back down to a big tuition increase. And so you had members like Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, who sits on the board, saying, you know, Regents, stop laying down and taking this. You know, don't take the predictable path of raising tuition. And instead, just say no, send a message to Sacramento. And one of the regents, his name is Norman Pattis, really took issue to that. And now he has laryngitis, but this was the first time he spoke. He spoke up and he was responding to the lieutenant governor who said to even think about voting no against these tuition hikes would jeopardize the entire system. And this is what he had to say.
We are at a precipice right now. We don't have the luxury of being able to say, let's send a message to Congress or to the, you know, to the state government. You are the state government, and there's nobody else from the state government here. So I'm going to get pissed at you.
And Anna Tintakalos, some of the frustration, some of the anger is that this coincides with some big pay increases for some of the top administrators in the system.
And therein lies the disconnect, you know, for many students and families. While they see these increases in not only with tuition, but textbooks, housing, other campus fees, they see these administrators getting pretty hefty salary increases. One in particular at San Diego State University, who got $100,000 more than his predecessor. And it just does not make sense to these families, and also to Governor Jerry Brown, who sent a letter to the regents really opposing these salaries.
And of course, beyond the numbers, there are people. And give us a sense, if you would, what these tuition increases mean for students and their families. How is it going to affect them?
Well, you know, I sat down and talked to some students at CSU Hayward in the East Bay in Northern California, and a lot of them are having to take more than one job to make ends meet. And so many students, what they're having to do is rely on their moms and dads, not only for housing, but just for their daily expenses. And Angelica Johnson, who is a student at CSU Hayward, has a 3-year-old daughter. This is what she had to say.
I don't even know how I made it. It's it's really hard right now. Yeah, because I've had help from my family too. So without them, I don't think I would have been able to finish.
Well, and sadly, this doesn't even really solve the problem. We're already hearing about a potential budget deficit next year, so probably more of the same to come, huh?
More of the same to come, and regents and CSU trustees say they hate to do it, but really it's their only option.
All right. Education reporter Anna Tintakalos. Anna, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, visit almost any big city in California, and you're sure to see people removing bottles and cans from garbage bins. The reason? Recycling pays. And as Amy Standen explains, it's actually having a positive impact on the economy.
Monet Coleman, I think it's fair to say, is not your average dyed-in-the-wool, tree-hugging environmentalist.
Actually, I never thought to really recycle, ever.
But a couple of months ago, she ran out of gas money and was late to her classes at nursing school. She wasn't finding part-time work. And that's when she started getting a lot more enthusiastic about garbage.
Go to a picnic. If you go to 5 relatives' house, you could come out with 2 full garbage bags of cans.
Take them here to Alliance Recycling in Emeryville, and you come out with real money. A few weeks ago, Coleman made $80.
Recycling is making a way for me right now. I guess it's my job.
That's true of a lot more people than it used to be, says Jay Annest, who owns Alliance Recycling. A few years ago, most of the people who came in here were pushing shopping carts. Now he's seeing late model Toyotas.
Since the economy burst a few years ago or popped, we've seen more people driving up, more of your middle class types, taking the recycling out of their trunk and walking it in. But we're getting quite a bit of that now.
Now, a lot of this stuff would have been put on the curbside and recycled anyway, but some of it wouldn't have. And that is one reason that recycling rates across the country have soared, according to Jerry Powell, who edits Resource Recycling magazine based in Portland, Oregon.
Aluminum can recycling at 58% is the best in 11 years, and soon more cans will be recycled than ever before.
And here in California, the rates are even higher, thanks in part to the state's bottle bill, which slaps a 5-cent redemption value on every aluminum, glass, and plastic beverage container from soda cans to water bottles. Last year, 82% of cans and bottles sold in California were recycled. That's up from 55% in 2003. People are recycling vastly more than they used to. It's a big shift. Recycling was once the icing, now it's the cake. And nowhere is this change as stark as it is in San Francisco.
They're approaching 70% recycling and only 30% garbage. And 15 years ago, it was completely the opposite.
What this means is that recycling is a bigger part of our economy than it has ever been before. Entire industries, here and abroad, literally can't survive without those bottles, cans, and cardboard boxes that you put out on the curb or bring into a recycling center.
But if the total recycling industry said stop and said they don't want to do any more recycling, you wouldn't have an American car made. They're mainly made out of recycled steel. You would have half of the newspaper because they only could get half that amount of paper. So recycling really now is just part of the normal economic order.
But when people start recycling more and throwing away less, there are growing pains. For example, Berkeley. For years, the city billed residents for garbage pickup. Recycling was free as a way of encouraging people to do more of it. But when people started throwing away less garbage, the city's revenues dropped. Berkeley has raised garbage rates 3 times in as many years. And then consider the landfills. Under a baking blue sky at Altamont Landfill near Livermore, a bulldozer rakes over the day's trash. It's been trucked up here from San Francisco and Alameda County and is now being crushed into the hillside.
Similar to mowing the lawn, you just go back and forth and back and forth.
Ken Lewis is the area director for this landfill, which is owned by the world's largest garbage company, Houston-based Waste Management. Lewis and I are standing on a massive pile of old garbage, almost every scrap of trash tossed by San Francisco residents for the past 30 years.
Municipal solid waste consists primarily of paper, organic materials, plastics, film plastic bottles, a lot of different types of materials that you would find in any household that have been thrown out over the years.
But times have changed. Almost every one of those things is now recyclable, which means more and more they aren't ending up here. And when you add in the fact that in a recession, people buy less stuff, that means this landfill is taking in a lot less trash than in the past.
This site accepts probably 2/3 of what it was accepting back around the turn of the century.
He means 1999 to 2000.
And the volumes are way down from San Francisco. They're way down from Alameda County and virtually every jurisdiction.
Once upon a time, California's politicians warned about a landfill crisis. Now, the state finds itself with enough existing landfill space to last nearly 50 years. But it also means that Waste Management is having to diversify its business. It's having to find ways to make a profit off of not throwing stuff away. For example, a couple years ago, this landfill became the first in the country to start sucking up natural gas from deep within the landfill and using it to power trucks, which means a lot less money spent on diesel fuel. Now, the company that named itself after an increasingly outdated concept, Waste, is seeking permits to build a composting station out here. For the California Report, I'm Amy Standen.
When people think of animal cruelty, smaller animals, like dogs and cats, often come to mind. But in rural areas, horses are often victims of abuse, neglect, even abandonment. Christina Russo reports on one Sonoma County veterinarian who's working to protect them.
You can often spot veterinarian Grant Miller on the road, making house calls for horses in Sonoma County.
On the surface, it can really seem like a blessing to an animal, you know, to be living in an area like this.
But Miller says the idyllic setting can be misleading.
Just because it looks pretty for us and has a desirable zip code doesn't mean that it isn't difficult for animals to live here. It just depends on how somebody chooses to care for them or not care for them.
Miller is the co-founder of Change, an organization that shelters, rehabilitates, and cares for abused and abandoned horses. He launched the program after assisting Sonoma County Animal Care and Control on a disturbing equine neglect case.
On a very hot August day in 2007, in over 100-degree heat, an emaciated black horse was found tied to a fence post in the glaring sun, with no water, no food, and no shelter.
As a local veterinarian, Miller was summoned to the scene.
This horse, Blackie, was a very gentle, sweet quarter horse gelding, but he was emaciated. He was just skin and bones. There was no palpable fat on his body. He was literally a living lesson in anatomy.
A few days later, Miller euthanized Blackie, but he says it was for the wrong reasons.
Not because medicine couldn't help him, but because we didn't have all of the logistical support set in place to do so. So you can't just simply help a horse medically. You have to have a facility. You have to have personnel. You have to have people there to watch the horse.
Miller realized how dire the situation was for the county's 20,000 horses, so he created Change, a public-private partnership with the county. The organization, which is buoyed by 200 volunteers, provides shelter and 24-hour medical care to horses confiscated by or relinquished to animal control. At the heart of Change is its foster barn network, some 40 privately owned barns that are willing to take in a horse at a moment's notice. Over the years, the program has cared for some 50 horses.
Good girl.
The most recent addition to the program is a horse named Mindy, who currently lives at the sprawling foster barn in Petaluma. Kelly runs the barn. We can't give her last name. It's part of a policy to protect horses from former owners. Kelly recalls Mindy's arrival this spring.
The way she looked in comparison to every other horse here was shocking. And in addition to that, she was covered in mud, and she had that big wound on one of her legs. It would just look like you brought a homeless person to the opera or something.
When an animal enters the Change program, it gets a personal set of equipment, like blankets, brushes, and halters. Miller says this provides the horse with some much-needed emotional comfort.
I wanted them to know that their bucket was their bucket, their brushes were their brushes, and they went with them where the horse went. And I'm very adamant about the supplies that we give to each horse following that horse throughout its rehabilitation process and then into its new adoptive home.
Mindy is blossoming and is now up for adoption. When she entered the program, she was 300 pounds underweight, but not anymore.
Mindy, you want a cookie? There you go. Good girl.
Besides the foster program, Change trains animal control officers in equine care. And Miller, who is also a forensics veterinarian, provides free expert witness services on cruelty cases. This commitment to law enforcement and justice is a central tenet of the program.
If you simply take a horse off of a property that somebody has abused, and if that person is never brought to justice, you're enabling them to do that again. So we recognize that this process starts and stops with the law.
Miller says one major lesson he's learned since starting Change is there's no profile of someone who abuses animals. The person can be any age, race, or gender, and from any economic class. Miller hopes the program will enlighten Sonoma County about the issue of horse cruelty, but he says it will be a long road ahead. According to his records, horse abuse cases are on the rise. For the California Report, I'm Christina Russo in Sonoma County.
And you can learn more about Grant Miller's Change program. Just follow the link on our website, californiareport.org. The wooden roller coaster on the Santa Cruz Boardwalk is a magnet for families, kids, and teenagers on dates. It also inspired musician David Lowery's song, Big Dipper. Lowery studied mathematics at UC Santa Cruz, and Big Dipper appears on the album titled The Golden Age, released in 1996 with his band Cracker. As part of our ongoing series, California Songs, Lowery talks about the story behind the music.
It's a portrait of Santa Cruz, like circa 1982, 83, 84. That Santa Cruz doesn't exist anymore. And so I wanted to, you know, make a still life of the city and the time.
Cigarettes and carrot juice. Get yourself a new tattoo for those sleeveless days.
Tattoos weren't very common before then. You know, good kids from middle-class homes in the valley who were going to school in Santa Cruz usually weren't getting tattoos. And there was something about that, like the pink flesh of a fresh tattoo on some before that innocent person, you know, was just interesting.
Could I take you out? I'd be yours without a doubt. On that Big Dipper.
It is sort of named after the roller coaster in Santa Cruz, although that is the Giant Dipper, but Big Dipper sounded better because it evoked the stars, the constellation.
But we could wait a while before we push that dull turnstile into the passage. The thousands they have tread, and others sometimes fled before the turn came.
It's a dull turnstile, you know, they're metal and it's got everybody's handprints all over it, and you know, I'm just one of many people. This is just one story of thousands of stories of people that go through this turnstile, that have gone through this. I'm no different than anybody else.
But if she asked me out, I'll be hers without a doubt. On that Big Dipper.
You have a broken heart. It's a really, something beautiful is just tormenting, you know, in a way. You know, a beautiful sunny day looking across the meadows, like of the Pogo Nip in Santa Cruz, across towards the Monterey Bay, would just be like, God, get me a rope. Good meadow to hang myself in.
I'm sitting on the Cafe Zeno steps. I haven't got the courage yet. I haven't got the courage yet. I haven't got the courage yet.
And you can hear more of David Lowery's conversation with producer Paul Lancourt, complete with a mathematics joke, at our website, californiareport.org. And finally today, baseball. It's often called America's pastime, but we rarely get to see what happens off the diamond or in the locker room. A new documentary series on Showtime promises to change that. The Franchise, a season with the San Francisco Giants, follows the World Series winning team, looking for intimate moments on and off the field. Here's a clip from the first episode with Giants pitcher Barry Zito, who's never quite lived up to expectations after signing a 7-year, $126 million contract.
What people don't realize is that we're just regular dudes, man, and we're just chasing our dreams.
Zito has pitched well this spring. 2 wins and a loss in the Cactus League, plus a 2.49 earned run average. So the Giants have been pleased with the way Zito has been throwing the ball.
The Franchise premiered Wednesday night on Showtime, with 5 more episodes scheduled to air through August. Mike Tolan is the show's executive producer, and he joins us now from NPR West in Culver City. Mike Tolan, good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
Well, my first question, of course, is why the San Francisco Giants? Of course, they did win the World Series last year, but I was thinking, you know, you might have done better in terms of pulling a national audience if it had been the Red Sox, the Yankees, a team like that. Well, why the Giants?
We were really looking for a combination of characters who we thought the audience would find entertaining, and ultimately a group that would give us the kind of access that we'd need to tell stories that would be honest, candid, fresh. So the truth is that the decision to go after the Giants and center the show around them was made before they had that trophy on the mantle. We started having the discussions last fall. The Giants were certainly in the conversation, and it was clear they were going to be a factor in the postseason play. But they had not yet won the championship when I started having a dialogue with the Giants president, Larry Bear.
You know, baseball players and athletes generally are often kind of masters of the cliche, you know, one game at a time, those sorts of phrases. They're not often revealing. How do you get players and people who are in a profession where they do guard their privacy and are not always the most articulate? How do you pull out interesting stuff from people like that and gain their trust?
When you start with a team that has Brian Wilson as a closer,
there's the beard.
There's a There's a reasonably good chance you're going to transcend the cliche. Brian Wilson sets a tenor, I think, for the clubhouse in a certain kind of way. He is beyond unguarded. He is always searching for the new and for the different. Not to say that he does it just to titillate. I think that's just who he is. I think he has an enormous amount of fun in his dealings with the media.
One of the most dramatic moments, no question, in the season so far for the Giants, and it was really a dramatic high point, I guess, in the premiere episode, was the season-ending injury to Buster Posey, the Giants catcher, who was last year's Rookie of the Year. Terrible collision at the plate in a game against the Florida Marlins. Obviously devastating to Posey, devastating to the Giants, but to you, it's luck in a sense, because it's a great story. How did you navigate that with the team?
Tricky. The Buster Posey incident presents, as you said, great opportunity for storytelling, but at the same time, it's a catastrophe for the team. So you kind of have to put your hurt feelings aside quickly and jump into action. And then ultimately, Buster was great about granting us time and giving us his own reflection. So I think we've really presented a very broad-based dialogue, covered all the bases. And at this point, we will continue to follow Buster's rehab over the next five episodes.
I watched the first episode, and I love the Giants. I'm a big fan. The whole city has become, Giants fans since the World Series last year. But if you're not a Giants fan, if you're not a baseball fan, why would you want to watch this series?
I've fallen in love with this team. I think the Giants are representing the best of professional sports. Again, this is a cast of characters that's made up of some cast-offs and some never-have-beens and some can-you-believe-where-they-are-now type guys. Ryan Vogelsong, I mean, a 34-year-old guy who in the last 12 months has been cut by two minor league teams, is now on the All-Star team. You know, we couldn't make that up.
Great story.
So I think there's some universality to the franchise and to what we're capturing with the Giants. And I've talked to a lot of my friends who are Pirates fans and Mets fans and Phillies fans who have seen something in what we've captured with the Giants that allows them a greater insight into their own team.
All right. Mike Tolan is executive producer of The Franchise, a season with the San Francisco Giants. It began airing this week on Showtime. Mike Tolan, thanks so much.
It's a pleasure being here, Scott.
And that is the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director this week is Sarah Bond. The technical producer is Seal Muller, with additional engineering from Paul Encore and Howard Gelman. The senior online editor is Gabriel Cohen, with help from David Marks. Our interns are Jefferson Beavers, Julia Bernstein, Bridget Bodner, and Nicholas Carpenter. Andrea Kissick was a contributing editor. The producers are Victoria Malione and Susie Racho, with help this week from Amy Machado. Ingrid Becker is our senior producer. The news director is Bruce Kuhn. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, everyone. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health happens. More information at calendow.org. And the SunPower Corporation, offering high-efficiency solar energy solutions to households and businesses in California and worldwide. The world standard for solar. SunPowerSolar.com.